Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Australia to speak with Vivian Altman, a senior producer on ABC TV's Foreign Correspondent program that broke the story of Prisoner X, who died 2 years ago in a secret Israeli prison where he's locked up under a false identity. Following extraordinary efforts by Prime Minister Netanyahu to muzzle the Israeli press from covering the story based on revelations from Australia's Foreign Correspondent program, we will discuss what is known about an Australian who was recruited by Mossad and apparently knew too many secrets that he took to his grave. Then we'll go to London and speak with the deputy editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye, Francis Ween, about a new outbreak of scandal engulfing Rupert Murdoch's British newspaper empire following yesterday's arrest of six former journalists with the now-defunct News of the World tabloid. We will discuss the likelihood of additional hundreds of millions of pounds being paid out in settlements and whether new press restrictions that the police and parliament are pushing will set back freedom of the press in the UK, where journalists already operate under onerous and antiquated libel laws. Then finally, we'll discuss this weekend's nationwide demonstrations against the controversial Keystone XL pipeline with May Bouvier, who is the executive director and co-founder of 350.org, which is leading the largest climate demonstration in Washington, D.C. at the National Mall on Sunday. Also joining me in the studio is the organizer of Tar Sands Action Southern California, Jack Eyte, who, in conjunction with actions across the country, is leading a rally in downtown Los Angeles, Solve the Climate Crisis, Take a Stand, Mr. President. Joining us now is Vivian Altman, who is joining us from Australia. She has been a journalist for over 25 years and has worked all over the world in radio and television. She's a senior producer and journalist at the Foreign Correspondent Program, ABC TV, that's the Australian Broadcasting Commission, and has won many international awards, including 2 Golden World medals, 3 silver medals, and 1 bronze medal at the New York Film and Television Festivals for stories in Colombia, India, Iran, and Ecuador. She was also twice nominated as a Walkley finalist, that's the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize, for stories in Yemen and Iran, and has won a UN Environmental Award for a story in Bolivia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vivian Altman.
Good morning.
Of course.
Or is it afternoon? I'm sorry.
No, it's evening here. I know it's the next.
Oh, good evening.
And I know you're already in Friday, so no matter what you do, you're ahead of us, Vivian.
Okay.
So tell me about the Australian, Ben Zygier, I guess is the pronunciation, who, from what your documentary has revealed, appears to have been recruited by Israel's Foreign Intelligence Service, the Mossad, in Melbourne. Apparently, he was a blue-eyed fellow who obviously didn't look particularly Middle Eastern and had an Australian passport, and apparently did operations for the Israelis, and then mysteriously died 2 years ago in an Israeli prison under a false identity. Let's begin with his recruitment in Melbourne, because apparently his father is a prominent member of Melbourne's Jewish community, is he not?
Yes, his father, Jeffrey Zygier, is a very prominent member of the Melbourne Jewish community. He's held quite a number of executive official positions. In relation to Ben, well, Ben grew up in Melbourne, went to Jewish schools, studied law at one of the main universities in Melbourne, and at some time during that, I think about perhaps in the year 2000, went over to Israel and went into the army, did his, you know, went to Israel for a year, did this the sort of gap year thing that young men and women from the diaspora do, went to Israel, went into the army, spent a bit of time at a kibbutz, and then came back to Australia and continued his or started his legal studies. Then later on, I think, returned to Israel, and it's not absolutely clear, but it would appear that he was recruited by Mossad, probably in Australia, and then went to live in Israel, eventually meeting and getting together, marrying an Israeli woman, and they went on to have 2 young children. He seemed, everything that we can glean, he was a very bright, intelligent young man with a lot of promise, a lovely, sensitive young man. who probably, I mean, it's hard to really know, just got in over his head, I think, or too deep. But yes, it's a very long and complicated and extraordinary story.
And of course, Vivian Ottman, nobody seems to know why he was arrested and why he was in prison under such extraordinary circumstances. The story is has been covered over here by the New York Times, but not it hasn't gotten much else traction. But in Israel, it is a roiling story. But it's mostly taken on the cast of being about Israel's onerous censorship laws. And it's led to the extraordinary situation where Prime Minister Netanyahu apparently met with the editors of all Israel's major newspapers and the heads of their television networks and threatened them if they reported on your story. That's pretty much what happened, isn't it?
Well, that happened initially. And then there was, in fact, a negotiation between the head of Mossad, I think, and the editors-in-chief and owners of print and other media, broadcast media. And I think the journalists in Israel are very courageous, but they were also very angry because it was just absurd. You know, of course, anyone could watch the program by just clicking on our link. And in fact, what you have is a situation where social media has, in fact, really made things different. So Israel, in reality, is not able to keep the story out of Israel. So, in fact, I think that there was some kind of negotiation that went on. They agreed, or they didn't agree, but in fact, the following day, the media organisations were represented in court. They were able to get the gag order changed, not completely lifted, but it meant that the foreign correspondent story could be broadcast on, you know, various television channels. It could be discussed, but there continue to be some limitations, and I think they include that journalists in Israel are not able to pursue the story any further. They are absolutely banned from talking or pursuing the wife, the family in Israel. But certainly it has raised a huge discussion in Israel, and I think that there will be some changes in general in relation to gag orders in the future.
What was the role of Australian intelligence in this? Because they seem to have had this story ahead of you, I take it. And they seem to be concerned about not just this Australian who died in the Israeli prison, but a couple of other Australian operatives in Mossad. And, of course, they returned to Australia to renew their passports. And apparently having an Australian passport and going on these operations in the Middle East was in a very important bonus, if you will, which may have been partially why they were recruited in the first place.
Look, absolutely. Having an Australian passport is a bonus, and it seems that there were three Australians who had been living in the Middle East and who had been recruited by the Mossad, who basically had European Jewish surnames, but who at various times during the 2000s, late 2000s probably, or mid to late, came back to Australia and got different passports. So, for example, in the case of Ben Zaga, he had passports. Well, we found that he had passports in three names, but since our story has broken, it seems that he may have had passports in four names. There were two other people involved. It is said that they were working for a European communications agency, but in fact that they did travel to Syria, Lebanon and Iran. And, you know, as you mentioned before, you know, having an Australian passport, having an Australian Anglo name and looking, you know, like an Anglo-Australian, more European than Middle Eastern, obviously, you're a very attractive person to an organisation like the Mossad.
And what do we know about what he did for Mossad, which obviously had something to do with him being imprisoned under such extraordinary circumstances, whether he was attempting to be a whistleblower or whatever it was? Do we know anything about his operations? Was he involved, for example, in the Dubai debacle over the killing of the Hamas operative?
Well, look, there's a certain amount of speculation about that at the moment. You'd be aware that there's some information that came out of, I think, Kuwait yesterday, or our last night yesterday, which is essentially, that is Australian last night, about him having, about Benazir having been involved in the Dubai hit. It's, I don't know, and I think the sources that were quoted, Western sources were quoted, and there was a photo that was put up suggesting it might have been actually him who had taken part in the hit. But look, we don't know that for sure. I think that there is one thing that probably, or two things that can be said. One, whatever he was doing, it was very serious. The Israelis didn't like it. They weren't happy about it. And two, he probably was about to spill the beans. Now, whether that was because there was a one report that said that he had gone to Dubai and said that he would give them information on the basis of being given protection. There are other reports which may have more credibility that say he was about to give information to the Australian government. It seems that something was going on. Possibly he was about to spill the beans and he was arrested.
And then he was literally locked up. They threw away the key, put him under a false identity in this top security prison. And he essentially disappeared first. And then sometime later, they were found out that he was arrested. And that the family knew and a lawyer knew, but nobody else knew. And it was a state secret, was it not, in Israel?
Absolutely. The case of Prisoner X, as in Benazir, was an, you know, people weren't allowed to talk about it. I mean, there were several gag orders. I think the first gag order came down in March. Remember, he was arrested in February. It seems there was contradictory information. We talked to the foreign minister just a couple of days before our story went to air.
That's Bob the Australian Carr, foreign minister, right?
The Australian foreign minister, Bob Carr. And he said to us, he told us that DFAT, that is Australian Foreign Affairs, had not been briefed, was not aware during the time that Benazir was in jail that he was in jail. And the only time that they found out that he was in jail was when he died, and the family asked him to actually assist, give consular assistance to help them bring his body back to Australia for burial. Now, that has since changed in the sense that it now appears that certainly the Australian, the International Australian Security Organisation, which is ASIS, was informed about almost immediately after he was arrested. And it seems that certain people in foreign affairs were also informed, but the Australian government was satisfied because they were told they sought assurances from the Israelis that Benazir would be given legal representation and, you know, decent conditions, and they didn't go any further. It also seems that the Australian ambassador in Tel Aviv may have been aware of the fact that he was, you know, in this secret jail. However, that is why the Australian Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, has called for an inquiry, which the results of which are expected probably sometime next week, into the handling of the whole affair.
So there is some question as to whether he got sufficient support from Australia. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I think that's certainly something that is being questioned and discussed at the moment.
But, Vivian Altman, nobody knows why he went into jail in the first place, what he did. and why he was such a threat to Israeli security that they went to such extraordinary lengths with these gag orders and this secret imprisonment. And the issues surrounding his death are also shrouded in mystery, are they not?
Yes, they certainly are. I mean, you know, the official death certificate says, you know, asphyxiation by hanging, but his lawyer, one of the lawyers who visited him, and I've seen contrary reports 1 or 2 days before, claims that he was very he was worried about his case. He was negotiating, or they were negotiating, with the state prosecutor's office in Israel about. He was doing a plea bargain, but he was in a reasonable state of mind. He was very focused, very clear. His wife was just about to have a second baby. I mean, literally, I think 4 days after he died, his wife had a second baby. He had everything to live for. And, of course, the question is being asked, you have a very secure, you know, a high-security jail. You have a hermetically sealed cell, which is supposed to be, which was the cell that was built especially for the assassin of Yitzhak Rabin. You have been, you know, it seems that there was constant monitoring, CCTV footage. So there's something odd, or shall we say, there are different views about what might have happened to him in relation to his death.
Well, Vivian Altman, I thank you very much for joining us here and for the film that you produced for the TV show that you produced for ABC, Australian Broadcasting Commission Television, the foreign correspondent program that has had so many international repercussions. One can only hope it is played over here at some point, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Vivian Altman from Australia. She's been a journalist for 25 years and has worked all over the world in radio and television. She is a senior producer and journalist at the Foreign Correspondent Program, ABC TV in Australia. She has won many international awards, and she has also been twice nominated as a Walkley finalist. That's the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize for stories in Yemen, Iran, and won the UN Environmental Award for a story on Bolivia. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talk about the latest scandals surrounding Rupert Murdoch.
Political bedlam. Don't let the hype into your eyes and eardrum. Murdoch on Fox, not 18 with Barackas. And he hate Barack cause he marched with the marches.
I pledge allegiance to the fair and balanced truth. Not the biased truth, not the liar's truth, but the highest truth. I will not be deceived, nor will I believe in the propaganda. I will not.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Francis Ween, who's a journalist, broadcaster, and writer. He's the deputy editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye, and he's written for a variety of publications and regularly appears on such BBC programs as The News Quiz. His books include the award-winning biography Karl Marx, A Life, Idiot Proof, A Short History of Modern Delusions, and Strange Days Indeed, The Golden Age of Paranoia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francis Ween.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And Rupert Murdoch, alias the Dirty Digger, is back in the news. I thought that he had dodged a bullet over the scandals, the multitude of scandals involving his newspapers in London. But apparently six journalists, former journalists from the News of the World, were just arrested.
Yes, they were. I mean, this has been going on for some time. It's hardly a week goes by without more Murdoch journalists or former Murdoch journalists being arrested. And actually, to start with, it was all quite entertaining because, you know, everyone hates journalists and most people hate Rupert Murdoch, and so a combination of the two, from the public's point of view, is irresistible. You know, the schadenfreude, the pleasure in seeing these people come a cropper, as we say over here. At that magical moment when Rupert Murdoch flew over to London to be interviewed by a House of Commons committee along with his idiot son, James Murdoch, and James was sort of playing the part of Bart Simpson, and Rupert, for once, was pretending not to be Mr. Burns from The Simpsons and sort of being more like Homer, saying, "Doll, this is the most humble moment of my life." Which Bart, in the film, of course, then says, "No, the most humble moment of your life so far." And that was all very enjoyable. But it's actually, most journalists I know are now beginning to feel the joke is wearing off, because although it's a pleasure to see Murdoch struggling, it's turning quite sinister for journalism over here, certainly. Because, newspapers are in a mess anyway at the moment. I mean, all over the world they're in a mess, trying to work out how they can stay in business when people are going online and advertising is collapsing and all the old models of, publishing a newspaper are no longer valid. At a time like this, the last thing you need is something that makes journalism even harder. And that's what's happening, certainly over here in Britain, because we had an inquiry set up under a judge called Lord Justice Leveson, which sat for about 2 years, and the government set this up as a way of getting itself off the hook. And it was meant to look into not just journalists and their misdeeds, but the police and politicians and their misdeeds, and the whole relationship between police and the press and politicians and the press, the way in which Murdoch had effectively bribed and cajoled and seduced political leaders over many years, and intimidated them as well, basically saying, we'll support you as long as you do what we say and let us have whatever we want in the way of creating media monopolies and bypassing normal laws. And unfortunately, when this report came out, it was scathing about the press, but it let the politicians and the police off the hook. And the police and the politicians, trying to capitalize on this and show that they're the good guys, are now really going for the press. I mean, the politicians are determined to have state-regulated newspapers. Only last week, the House of Lords passed a bill... which would mean that any newspaper which does not sign up to a state-appointed regulatory system could be given exemplary damages and made to pay enormous costs and generally punished and pummeled for not allowing itself, and even to the extent of having to pre-submit articles to this state regulator. So they say you have to... any vaguely contentious article would have to be sent in for pre-clearance, as I think they call it, to this state regulator before you publish it. I mean, this takes us back hundreds of years. We thought some of these struggles for the free press, from John Wilkes onwards, had been fought and won, but now we're heading backwards because the politicians want to show that they're cracking down, and the police are just the same. I mean, they go around arresting Murdoch journalists in the most dramatic, eye-catching, camera-catching fashion. I mean, they knock on the doors of these people at 6 in the morning and get them out of their beds and come storming in and drag them off. It's a bit like, that phenomenon of the perp walk, the pleasure that the police take in making someone do the perp walk in full view of the cameras. And it's like that. It's purely a media stunt, a publicity stunt. They could just as well turn up at 10 o'clock in the morning rather than 6 or 5 in the morning. And they don't have to go about it so mob-handed. It's not as if these are dangerous killers or armed robbers. These are just sort of hopeless old Murdoch hacks who aren't going anywhere. But they're doing it to salve their consciences, the police, and the politicians are. And actually, some of us in the press, even though we deplore what the Murdoch papers were doing, are beginning to feel that the persecution is getting out of hand, and that some of these people who are arrested may or may not have committed offences. Nobody knows yet because they haven't yet come to trial, but many of them, I suspect, won't. But there is a slight feeling that it's just become arresting journalists for the sake of it, almost.
It would seem, though, that the possibility of a whole new slew of these high-profile phone hacking victims suing News Corp, which is, I think, months away from floating a separate new company can't be welcome. I understand your point about the police being perhaps overzealous to overcompensate for the fact that it looked like half of Scotland Yard was on Murdoch's payroll. But tell me about how much this is likely to cost and how much it's going to go on for Murdoch. My understanding is that this whole thing could continue until 2019.
Oh, it will continue for a long time because, I mean, there will be trials. I mean, some people have already been charged and are awaiting trial, not least a woman called Rebecca Brooks, who was the chief executive of Murdoch's company over here, News International, his newspaper company. She and her husband, indeed, are awaiting trial, as is a man called Andy Coulson, who was editor of the News of the World, the famous paper that was closed down, and later went on to be communications director for the Prime Minister, David Cameron, at 10 Downing Street. So, you know, these are just the beginnings. I mean, they've arrested so many people. They've charged a few, but I think they will charge a few more. And these trials are going to go on for, you know, they'll be rattling through the courts for a good few, you know, another 4 or 5 years, I should think. And on top of that, there are all these compensation cases that you mentioned, because some of them have settled. But every time you think it's calming down, or every time Rupert thinks it's calming down, then new evidence comes to light. More people are arrested. I mean, the six people who were arrested yesterday, the six journalists, are arrested in connection with a completely different set of allegations about phone hacking. I mean, it's all a bit, it's one for the, you know, for the connoisseurs and the geeks, this one, but they are actually different from the previous arrests, because all the previous ones were based on records kept by a private detective who worked for the News of the World. Private investigator, and they were all from basically from the newsroom, whereas these people are all from the features department of the News of the World, and they're not from the records of the private detective. So the police have opened up a whole new line of inquiry. So we can expect more arrests, I suspect, over the next few weeks, and more claims for compensation, because even people who've settled, like the actor Hugh Grant and Jude Law and Sienna Miller and all these other various actors and actresses, they may well now start new claims for compensation over these separate allegations of phone hacking. You know, they may then discover that other people at the News of the World in different in the features department were hacking their phones, and they can start the whole process all over again and demand even more compensation. And it's a, I mean, it's a nightmare for Murdoch. I mean, no one knows what the ultimate bill will be, least of all him. But I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of pounds, of British pounds sterling, hundreds of millions of dollars. Certainly. I mean, I think over 200 million, quite possibly.
Well, apparently 144 out of the 169 civil suits filed against the News of the World have been settled. And you mentioned Hugh Grant, of course, the scandal-prone Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, Uri Geller, God knows what they wanted to know about him, Richard Reardon.
The secret of his spoons, I think.
And this priest who ministered to the singer, Charlotte Church. Apparently the biggest settlement so far is $1.2 million, which was paid out to Gordon Taylor, the head of Britain's Soccer Players Union.
That's right, yes. Well, he got in early, and he got it, and they paid him so much because at that stage they thought they could contain the scandal. And so when he sued, when he discovered that his phone had been hacked, and he sued them, they thought, if we pay him a seven-figure sum, you know, a sum he can't refuse, and as part of the deal, say that he's not allowed to speak about it, then we could still keep the lid on it, and it may, you know, it may go no further than that. That was what they were hoping at the time. That's why they paid him so much, and that nearly worked. Except that, in 2009, the Guardian then exposed the fact that they had paid him £1 million, and everything came flooding out, and suddenly there were dozens and dozens of other people reaching for their lawyers and bringing in lawsuits.
It's pretty amazing, though, don't you think, Francis Wien, how Murdoch has insulated himself, his vast holdings over here in the United States, and his influence in the media here. I don't know whether you followed the story of General Petraeus, but Bob Woodward, of famous from the Watergate story, All the President's Men, he broke the story, provided an audio tape, which was buried in the style section of the Washington Post. But nevertheless, it was one of the most extraordinary tapes where an emissary from Roger Ailes, who runs Fox News, was basically offering the presidency on a plate to General Petraeus, with Roger Ailes taking a leave of absence from Fox News to run a Petraeus campaign, of course, against Obama in the last election, and Rupert would pay for it, and it was a done deal, and all he had to do was sign on the dotted line. And of course, in order to get General Petraeus off the street, Obama, who obviously knew about this offer from Fox, gave him the job at the CIA, which the CIA resented because they didn't like this imperious general, and they then plotted behind the scenes to bring him down. Obviously, he made it easier for them with his ridiculous affair with the biographer. So there is another tale.
Well, I know. I mean, that was an astonishing tale, and as you say, one of the many astonishing things about it was the Washington Post saw fit to put it in the style section. I mean, Carl Bernstein actually wrote a very good piece about it at the time, which was published over here in The Guardian. I don't know if it appeared anywhere in the States, but I assume it did somewhere, saying, you know, why was this not on the front page? This is, you know, front page news. It's not a style story that a media mogul is actually basically trying to buy the presidency. I mean, you know, Rupert Murdoch, his whole career in Australia, in America, in Britain, has been full of cases of him palling up with chumming up with particular political leaders and doing a deal with them, an implicit deal, saying, right, my papers will back you. I mean, he did it with Gough Whitlam in Australia, but then as often as not, he drops them. And he'll, you know, if he thinks they're turning into losers, he will switch his allegiance absolutely ruthlessly and support somebody else and turn all his papers against his previous friend and support his new friend, and in return expect a lot of favours back. But the Roger Ailes proposal seemed to me to be a new level of Murdoch. You know, instead of trying to seduce an existing political leader, he was trying to create his own president, you know, sort of buy Petraeus before he'd even thought of being a candidate, and say, look, we will run your campaign, finance your campaign, support you. You know, we've got a ready-made presidential campaign for you. You just sign on the dotted line and we'll do the rest. It was extraordinary. And that, I do wonder what's going on at the Washington Post if they don't think that's worth a news story.
But still, the question is hanging. Why is it that in Britain they've gone after Murdoch for his manifest crimes, yet in the United States, the idea that he was trying to fix the presidency and literally buy somebody who would actually be likely to be elected. I mean, the American people are probably sufficiently ill-educated to think that this war hero, whose resume is largely bogus, would be a savior for the United States. That
it's sort of echoes of the Manchurian Candidate, really, isn't it? I mean, it is such a weird story. And all those other films, not just the Manchurian Candidate, but, you know, The Candidate, with Robert Redford, otherwise known as Bob Woodward, and all sorts of, I mean, sort of recurring themes through American films, the idea of, you know, a political candidate who then, you know, it falls prey to sponsors and Svengalis and various other secretive forces that are up to no good. Well, the parallax view, I mean, the inverse version of it, where, you know, you get bumped off by a corporation if you don't do as they tell you. And Murdoch seems, I think, all those years running 20th Century Fox, he can no longer distinguish between some old movie he's seen, some conspiratorial paranoid thriller, and real life. And he's tried to turn real life into one of those films.
But he's had a very toxic effect over here, not just in terms of politics and making politics over here more poisonous and partisan, which is clearly the case, it's to the point where Washington is gridlocked. But he's also probably single-handedly been more responsible for global warming denial. And here you have his home country of Australia literally baking with bushfires and floods, and yet somehow he doesn't make the connection, or if he does, he doesn't care.
Well, oddly enough, there was a brief period where he pretended to care, because his son James, when James Murdoch was the heir apparent, James got into, you know, the environment and became green and made a big push of this and said, we're going to be the greenest corporation in the world. And so his, you know, his indulgent father had to humour him and say, oh yes, James, that's right, we'll be very green, yeah, yeah, yeah. And so even, you know, raucous right-wing tabloid newspapers like The Sun in London were suddenly running these earnest, tree-hugging editorials and things, and going on and on about how we must all reduce our carbon footprint. And but of course, one of the many casualties of the scandals of the last 2 years is James Murdoch. You know, that was the end of his really of his status as the favourite son and the man who would inherit everything. And the moment James was made a bit of a fall guy for it, of course Rupert could then stop pretending and go back to his natural self, which was, what's all this global warming rubbish? No, we don't want that. As you say, he's now back to being a climate change denier, and he's which I'm sure he was all along, but he suspended it for about 2 or 3 years.
Well, just in closing,
in Australia, in his native Australia, I mean, of all the places. But the weird thing is Australia, which, as you say, I mean, it's sort of, the country is burning, and it has a very, very vociferous and noisy climate change denial movement. And indeed, Tony Abbott, the leader of the opposition in Australia, who may or may not become prime minister before this year is out, is himself that way inclined.
Well, and so, by the way, is the Republican front runner to run in the next presidency, Marco Rubio, who
I saw him doing his reply to the State of the Union last night, and I thought, good grief, this man could be the Republican candidate in 4 years' time.
Yes, that the government doesn't control the climate.
Rupert, I mean, Rupert is quite old. I mean, there must come a moment where even Rupert Murdoch has to ease off a bit. I mean, no sign of it yet. I mean, his tweets are hilarious. He so loves Twitter. Now he's discovered it. I mean, he's always been a late adopter, Rupert. I mean, when the internet came along, he couldn't understand it, and so he thought it wasn't important. And so his papers were very late in going online. And then, of course, because he left it so late, he panicked and bought up MySpace for far too much money and lost an absolute fortune on it. So he's always been a bit clumsy about that sort of thing. But he's now found Twitter, and it's added a whole new dimension of terror to being a Murdoch editor, because they have to look at his tweets all the time to find out whether they're going to be sacked or whether he's publicly denouncing them. I mean, only this week, over here in The Sun, this tabloid paper of his, ever since he bought it in 1969, he's had page three girls, which every day on page three of this paper, they have a topless woman, a large photo of a topless woman showing her breasts. It's been going on for decades, and he's always supported it. I remember once being thrown out of his flat. His previous wife, Anna Murdoch, I went around to talk to some years ago, and I'd heard that she was embarrassed, at dinner parties and things, if people mentioned that her husband owned this paper with all these topless women in it, and that she didn't like it. And so I put it to her and said, are you not embarrassed by this? And she got very angry. She said, my husband is a great man. How dare you suggest that I could be embarrassed by anything he does? Get out of my... She summoned the butler to throw me out. But on Twitter the other day, some ordinary woman in Britain tweeted him and said, topless women, page three girls, are so 20th century, we're so over them. And he suddenly tweeted back, yeah, you may be right, actually. I think we may have to stop them. And this is the first the editor of The Sun had heard about it. And again, they had a cartoon in the Sunday Times in London, and the editor of the Sunday Times was defending it against people who said it was anti-Semitic. It showed Netanyahu building a wall with blood of Palestinians or something, and by a Gerald Scarfe cartoon. And the editor was defending it, and then someone said to him, I think you better look at Twitter. Rupert Murdoch has just apologised for it without telling you.
Okay. Just in closing, Francis Wien, is there any news on the succession? Eventually he will meet his maker, Rupert, and I'm assuming it'll be as opposed to the one up in the Pearly Gates.
I don't think he'll meet his maker. I think he'll go for it. It's like it reminds... Actually, he does remind me a bit of... about 10 years ago, when I was in Cuba, in Havana, and Fidel Castro was there at an event, and I was talking to one of the people by him, and even then he was quite old, and I said, well, presumably when Fidel Castro goes, when he dies, and he said, no, we don't say that over here. We say if. And it's a bit like that with Murdoch. No one dares say to him, well, actually, you're mortal, Rupert. You're not going to go on forever. Because no one's told him. He's unstoppable. He's full of plans, full of ideas, and having a great time. But he's the succession is a terrific mess because, well, you know, he so wants to hand it over to a child of his, and his shareholders so don't want that. I mean, the shareholders are utterly fed up with this dynastic approach. You know, the Kim Il Sung handing over to Kim Jong Il and Kim Jong Un. It's just like that. It's sort of, you know, Keith, his father, Sir Keith Murdoch, handed over his rather tiny press empire to Rupert, and then Rupert creates an enormous empire and wants to hand it over to somebody. And first of all, there was Lachlan, and then he lost interest, and so James was promoted, and Elizabeth Murdoch then wandered off to do her own thing. She's now very much back, actually. She's now probably in a better position than either of those boys. But of course, there's the new generation, the young school-age children now. So if Rupert lives long enough, maybe the new children with his latest Chinese wife will be old enough for him to anoint them as heirs. But I don't think that, I mean, there comes a point where the shareholders, although they respect Rupert and they don't like to challenge him directly, you know, they're not going to tolerate him just imposing some unqualified child of his as the supreme commander of the great Murdoch Empire all over the world if it's going to affect the share price and going to affect their investment. I mean, sooner or later they're going to have to take him aside and say, look, Rupert, we're very grateful you've created a wonderful thing. We've all made lots of nice money out of it. But, you know, we don't want someone called Murdoch running this ever again.
Well, Francis Wheen, I thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all.
Again, I've been speaking with Francis Wheen, who is a journalist, broadcaster and writer. He's the deputy editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye, and he's written for a variety of publications and regularly appears on such BBC programs as The News Quiz. His books include the award-winning biography Karl Marx, A Life, Idiot Proof, A Short History of Modern Delusions, and Strange Days Indeed, The Golden Age of Paranoia. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about nationwide demonstrations this Sunday against the Keystone XL pipeline.
Sacred land, and it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is May Bouvier, who is the executive director and co-founder of 350.org, where she works on international partnerships and political strategy. She was the recipient of the Brower Youth Award in 2006 and is the co-author of Fight Global Warming Now. 350.org will be leading the Forward on Climate demonstrations against the Keystone XL pipeline, the largest climate demonstrations in Washington, D.C. to date, at the National Mall on this coming Sunday, February the 17th. And also joining us is Josh Mogerman, who is a spokesman for the Natural Resources Defense Council. And in the studio is Jack Eyte, a writer, urban theorist, environmental advocate, and co-director and co-founder and director of Wild Heritage Planners. He's editor of wilderutopia.com, where he has an article, Word to the President, Action on Climate and Keystone Now. His organization, Tar Sands Action Southern California, is leading a rally in downtown Los Angeles, Solve the Climate Crisis, Take a Stand, Mr. President, this coming Sunday in solidarity with the demonstrations in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing to you all. Let me begin with you, May Bouvier. You're obviously going to have the largest climate demonstration in Washington, D.C. to date. I recall that it was your organization that brought the whole issue of Keystone to the attention of the president, with Bill McKibben leading demonstrations in front of the White House, that essentially put this issue on the map, did it not?
Well, we've certainly been working hard on this issue for a long time, alongside some of the people on this call, and certainly with a lot of our allies in Canada. But the rally is looking very, very good for this weekend, and we've really reached a point where it's time to show that the American people are really ready for strong climate action. And stopping the Keystone XL pipeline is a very clear way for the president to match his very important words with some very serious actions.
And Josh Mogamon, the spokesman for the Natural Resources Defense Council, of course, just a few days ago, the president in his State of the Union talked both about dealing with the challenge of climate change and put forth an ambitious agenda. At the same time, he talked about energy independence, more leases for oil and gas, etc. Is there a contradiction there?
Well, there's certainly a need for action, and he finds himself at a very interesting point right now. He has two really major decisions that that he's going to have to make that relate to the carbon footprint of this country. The first one is the one we're talking about now, the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline, and the other one is dealing with emissions from power plants. He has the authority and the responsibility to limit the amount of industrial carbon pollution emitted from power plants. That's 40% of the pollution that we have right now, carbon pollution, that is, and he has that authority under the Clean Air Act. And these two decisions that he's going to have to make very quickly and hopefully take action on really give us a chance to set the course to reduce carbon pollution domestically. And it sends the right signals internationally so that other countries can follow our lead.
And Jack Art, your organization, Tar Sands Action Southern California, is leading a rally in downtown Los Angeles. Solve the climate crisis. Take a stand, Mr. President. What stand do you want the president to take?
Well, the first order of business is that the Keystone XL pipeline, as has been stated, needs to be rejected. Basically, it's a 1,700-mile pipeline that's already underway in its southern leg. It connects the tar sands of Alberta, the largest industrial project on the face of the planet and most damaging right now. And so it crosses the whole United States, much eminent domain, required farmland and open range. It crosses rivers and the Ogallala Aquifer. The first Keystone pipeline spilled 12 times in its first year of operation. This is an extremely dangerous development there, and also the tar sands oil is when it's burned, it burns 3 to 5 times more carbon intensive than regular Saudi crude. So it's a very dangerous prospect for the climate as well as for our natural resources.
And May Bouvier, the executive director and co-founder of 350.org. My understanding is, in fact, Bill McKibben told me that he's flown over this area. It requires enormous amounts of water to separate, and they have to heat the water to separate the tar from the sands. And there's vast amounts of lakes of brackish water that he described as looking like Mordor. My understanding is that the Alberta, while it's an oil-friendly province in Canada, and the prime minister is from Alberta, Stephen Harper, and he's an oil-friendly prime minister, the next-door state of British Columbia is much, much less friendly, and it's unlikely they'll allow a pipeline. So the only way to get this oil out now, or this thick, viscous tar sands oil, is via this XL pipeline through the United States. Is that the situation?
You're exactly right, and that's why this is so important and why the movement around this country and in Canada has become so vibrant, because people have seen that the Keystone XL is really becoming a focal point for the tar sands industry. And it's not just us saying this. The tar sands industry executives themselves have demonstrated in numerous statements that without the refining capacity that lies at the root of the Keystone XL, tar sands are somewhat landlocked in Alberta. And so that's what we're going to see this weekend. We're going to see people streaming into Washington, D.C., who know these issues very deeply, people whose lands would be affected if the tar sands were built, people in Texas who are already being affected right now, people who live near refineries, and people who have watched this movement build and know this is an important moment to send a clear message to the president. So our hope with this weekend is that we're going to see this incredible breadth of this climate movement that's really come together and really sees Keystone XL as a major focal point for the president and our movement, and that if we can lead on this issue, there's so many things we need to do. We need to regulate coal power plants. We need to increase energy efficiency standards. And if we can generate this momentum by President Obama standing up, we will be in such a better place than we are right now.
And Josh Mogerman, the spokesman for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Former NASA scientist Jim Hansen has described the XL pipeline, if it's completed, as being game over for the environment. My understanding is that the idea is those refineries down in Texas process Venezuelan crude, which is also very thick and viscous, not as much so as the tar sands, and that in many ways it appears that we don't want to have to depend upon Venezuelan oil. Is that a subtext there? Is there a kind of national security dimension to this?
You know, there have been a lot of reasons put forth by the pipeline pushers. Certainly that's one of them. They usually talk about not wanting to give our money to Iran and Middle Eastern countries, despite the fact that most reporting makes it clear that this is not going to offset Middle Eastern oil. There's also been the story told that this was going to create hundreds of thousands of jobs. That also has been largely debunked. There are a lot of reasons that have been put forward about this pipeline being in the national interest. But ultimately, they've all been knocked down. And, you know, ultimately, this is something that is in big oil's best interest. It's not in the nation's best interest. And we hope that the president will take action and say no to it accordingly. You know, I'm calling you from Chicago, just across Lake Michigan from the Kalamazoo River, which is the site of the worst inland oil spill in our nation's history. It was tar sands oil that was dumped into the waterway, about 1 million gallons, and 2.5 years later, we are still cleaning it up. You know, beyond the carbon issues that are associated with Keystone XL and with tar sands, there is the broader environmental impact, and this is something that we don't need spanning our country at this point. We don't need the oil. There isn't demand for it. This is oil that is largely being slated for export and international use, and it's just not in the country's interest. And we hope the president will see that.
And Jack, normally the NIMBY, not in my backyard, is a big issue. You're leading a demonstration here in Los Angeles in conjunction with these nationwide protests on Sunday. The pipeline's not going through L.A., so how are you inspiring Angelenos to get involved?
Well, I think Angelenos are, we see what's going on in the news with the climate issues that are, the melting of the glaciers, all the superstorms that are happening. I think people are ready to see action from the president. And the good thing is that the president has indicated that he's considering action. So we need an energy policy that's focused on efficiency and conservation integrated with a clean, renewable energy plan, meaning we need to cut down our use of fossil fuels, any sort of fuels. We need smarter transportation. We need to rethink our cities. There's any number of things that are necessary. But the first thing is to stop these damaging projects. As was mentioned, regulating coal plants is a very important thing, and one of our main organizers is the Beyond Coal campaign here in LA. So the transition to solar, wind, geothermal, and other renewables will clean up our air, improve the health of millions, and create thousands of jobs. It's good for all of us. We understand that although there's a land area of the boreal forest the size of Florida that would be destroyed if they push this project forward, it's far away, but we recognize the impacts to the climate of mining and transporting and burning. That is something that we all care about. So that's why many, many organizations in LA have shown support with the DC rally that's going on.
And May Bouvier, again, the executive director and co-founder of 350.org, you're up against some of the biggest corporations in the world, ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and Royal Dutch Shell. They've all heavily invested in the tar sands operation. What is the leveler here? I mean, I understand in terms of global warming, and a lot of those countries have invested in global warming denial. I take it that there are some corporations that are interested in the global warming reality. Perhaps insurance companies are all going to go broke. Is there a way to get a broader coalition, not just people, but corporate power as well, to fight this fight? This so far pretty one-sided fight.
Well, I'm glad you asked about that. And actually, just today in Washington, D.C., where I'm calling you, Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Barbara Boxer introduced a new bill. And right up on the line with them talking about this new project was the director of Public Citizen, an organization that focuses very strongly on the issue of money in politics. And you're right to point that out. And I think the memory of the last election and the record levels of spending are very fresh in everyone's minds. And when you start thinking about climate change and our energy policy, you can't think much about it without jumping to money and politics as an issue. So I'm very glad that a lot of our partners on this rally over the weekend are really focused on that. Groups like Represent Us and a lot of these new movements that are emerging to try and confront really what is an issue of corruption in terms of the level of money polluting this debate. And there's no question that we're up against a very formidable foe. We just completed a nationwide Do the Math tour where we were describing that the oil, coal, and gas companies have five times more carbon on their books, in their balance sheets, than scientists say is safe to burn. And so the profit motive is huge, and it's bent on cooking the planet. We have to move away from that.
And Josh Mergerman, spokesman for the Natural Resources Defense Council, what do you say to the drill baby drill people in this country?
Well, we've been drilling baby drilling, and it hasn't really worked out very well. They promised us low gas prices. They promised us energy independence. And, you know, those things have not happened. We actually are close to energy independence if we start shifting towards a heavier focus on renewables. We have plenty of energy in those respects. But, you know, ultimately, this is, you know, the drill baby drill crowd is all about domestic energy. This is important to remember that this pipeline is not largely for domestic consumption. This is an export pipeline. This is all about taking those landlocked tar sands from Alberta and making them available for foreign markets, by the way, through a tax-free international business zone in Texas. So this is about the bottom line for the oil companies. This is not about what's in the best interest for the American public. What's in the best interest for the American public is dealing with climate change.
Well, I thank all of you for joining us here. May Bouvet, the executive director of and co-founder of 350.org, Josh Mergerman, spokesman for the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Jack Eyde here in the studio. People should come and join you on Sunday, downtown Los Angeles. What time and where? Quickly.
1 o'clock, meeting at Union Station right across there at Olvera Street, and we're going to march to City Hall.
I thank all of you for joining us. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.